Apparently, the people who choose the passages to include in the lectionary must think that the lives of preachers like me are far too sedate, that we need a little more excitement in our lives, and they have decided to do something about that. Given the battle of the sexes that continues to rage as but one theater in the larger culture war, assigning Proverbs 31, the famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, ode to a capable wife, as the Old Testament lesson lands the preacher squarely in the middle of a minefield. And once this passage was the exclusive province of funerals for women like my grandmother, or it was reserved for preaching on Mother's Day to extol those women who stay at home supporting husbands and raise children. Only now the text has been reappraised by a number of scholars, including, importantly, female scholars, who have begun to raise new and different questions about the passage and have given us new ways to approach and understand it. James Hopkins warns that if Proverbs 31 is only about thanking mothers on Mother's Day, or paying tribute to godly women on the occasion of their deaths, we preachers do the text a disservice. By reading and preaching Proverbs 31 only when it has a ceremonial function, we keep it safely away from the power structures of our churches and communities. Hearing it only on Mother's Day or at funerals means that churches generally don't have to ask the important questions that Proverbs 31 raises. And despite what it says about women's abilities to do things beyond cooking and cleaning and caring for children, we preachers, and I should say generally we male preachers, have not allowed ourselves or our congregations to hear what the text is really saying. But that's the question, isn't it? What is the text really saying? One way, perhaps the traditional way that we read the text, is to say that a truly godly woman finds her place in the home, where she exercises the power proper to her sphere. She cooks, she cleans, she manages the household. This, says one reading, is what this text is about. I, for one, happen to be of the opinion that a woman's place is in the House of Representatives, and the Senate, and the Cabinet, and the Oval Office, to say nothing of the endowed faculty chair and the executive suite and the operating room and the pulpit. Now, read another way, perhaps a more feminist way, this passage is one of women's empowerment. Look at what women can do, this reading says. Not only at what women can do, but what women have done, even under the most oppressive and patriarchal of conditions. It takes a woman to work two jobs day and night, putting food on the table and clothes on her family's backs, pleasing her husband, and making it look easy all the time. On this reading, the Proverbs 31 woman is the original Ginger Rogers, doing everything that Fred Astaire did except, say it with me, backwards and in high heels. Thank you, Ann Richards. Read a third way, the text becomes a burden on women who are taught that this is what it means to be a woman, a wife, and mother. It creates an overwhelming ideal, an almost impossible job description, almost a portrayal of a spiritual Martha Stewart. Right? A woman who can do it all and do it flawlessly, except for the part of going to federal prison. We don't want women to do that. But my friends, I want to suggest to you that there is still another way in which we might read the passage, one that doesn't simply praise stay-at-home moms, though stay-at-home moms deserve all the praise they can get, a way that doesn't simply celebrate strong women and all women deserve to be celebrated, nor a way that sets up unreal and inhuman expectations. I want to wonder with you, friends, what if the capable wife of Proverbs 31 isn't a wife necessarily, but as the Hebrew allows us to read it, a woman. And one who, depending on your translation, isn't simply capable or competent, but one who is of noble character. One who is virtuous, even valorous, strong, an excellent woman. And what if this woman isn't merely a human woman? I mean, you read the text and you think, God, no, she's Superwoman, Wonder Woman. I can't be that. What if she's not a human woman at all? But what if, as a reading of the entirety of Proverbs would suggest, she is a poetic figure? The woman Wisdom, a woman we heard last week crying out in the streets for people to listen to and follow her. But as we heard, who can find this capable, this virtuous, this noble, this excellent woman? Though she is to be sought, she is apparently not easily acquired. And yet, once she is far more precious than jewels. Having wisdom will bring no lack of gain to the household. That exhaustive list of all the things she does, spinning and farming and buying land and providing food and clothes, shows just how prudent and beneficial it is to anyone, male or female, to partner with wisdom and let her be the source of life's good things. But the key is that we trust wisdom the way an intelligent husband trusts his wife, giving her free rein to govern and manage the temporal and spiritual affairs of the household. Rather than the advice of Oprah or Oz, rather than the preachments of Orman and Osteen, we should put woman wisdom first. Seeking to be like her, for her teaching is peaceable and pure. It gives strength and dignity. We ought to allow wisdom to be at work in our lives, for she is herself industrious and energetic. She is creative and farsighted, and at the same time, generous to the poor, dignified and kind. Now, I've suggested to you that we consider that wisdom is not really a woman at all, not a human woman, but let's flip it and let's say that she was. And if this Proverbs 31 woman is a human woman, she is probably like that mom who drives the carpool and collects her kids and those of other families from school and kind of listens silently as the kids in the back chatter about who's done what and who's going out with whom and who kissed who under the bleachers, and smiles to herself but doesn't say anything, only to bring the kids home and turn on them and say, "What were you kids talking about in the car on the way home from school?" Jesus pulls the same maneuver on the disciples when he asks them, "What were you guys talking about on the way?" Now understand that the way doesn't simply mean the road or the highway, or rather it does mean the highway, two words. It means Jesus' way, the way of forgiveness and compassion, the way of hospitality and patience, the way that leads to God. What were you talking about on the way? Rather than answering the question, the disciples fall into a kind of embarrassed silence. Because rather than talking about Jesus' teachings or discussing amongst themselves how they could be more faithful disciples, instead of thinking about how they could invite more people to meet Jesus, rather than thinking about how they might expand Jesus' ministries, the disciples had been arguing among themselves as to which of them was the greatest. Just like Peter had done but a few days before, they had set their minds not on divine things, but on human things. I think the question, who is the greatest, is a compulsive human question. Who's the smartest, or the fastest, or the prettiest? Who's the most popular, the most talented, the most likely to succeed? We compete with one another to be named Salesperson of the Year or Most Valuable Player, and sometimes that competition is healthy because it calls forth from us our God-given gifts, challenges us to use them to our fullest human potential. But other times that competition brings out the worst in us. Jealousy, greed, cruelty. If you want to know what I'm talking about, just go to a Little League game and watch the parents, or go to Texas cheerleader tryouts. You'll kind of get the idea. Knowing who is the greatest, though, serves an important purpose. It tells us who's who in the zoo, who's hot, who's not, who's in, who's out, who's weak, who's strong, who is important, who can be neglected, who is to be served, and who is to serve. Only Jesus says that's not how it is to be along the way. That's not how it is to be among Jesus' followers. Because Jesus doesn't play by the world's old rules of might makes right, and every person for himself, and get as much as you can before you leave the game, and everybody's equal, but some are more equal than others. So Jesus decides that it's time for an object lesson. If the first lesson in discipleship is the Son of Man must be betrayed and suffer and be killed and 3 days after being killed rise again, the second lesson is that his followers must deny themselves and take up the cross and follow Jesus. The third lesson in discipleship follows from the first two. Namely, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. But that kind of thinking turns on its head everything we know about the world and how to get ahead in it. You get ahead by looking out for number one, by cutting a few corners if you have to, by stepping on a few people on your way to the top. After all, you can't enjoy omelets without breaking a few eggs. Jesus has a word for those who are climbing their way to the top of the corporate or the social or the economic ladder. To be number one, Jesus says, requires being last in line. To get to the top, Jesus says, you have to stay at the bottom. The way to the kingdom, Jesus says, leads through the servants' quarters. And then to show his success-minded disciples what life is really all about, Jesus shows them a model. Only Jesus doesn't pull out Forbes magazine with Donald Trump's picture on the cover. He doesn't pull out a copy of Martha Stewart Living. Instead, Jesus reaches for a child, probably one with a cowlick and a Kool-Aid grin, or one who hadn't yet outgrown the baby fat, a kid with average grades and average looks, and embraced that child. You want to be a rock star, Jesus says. You want to be number one. You want to get somewhere in life, Jesus asks. Then welcome one such as these. Put them first. And the disciples probably thought, you have got to be kidding me. I mean, sure, everybody loves their kid and puts her macaroni art on the fridge and thinks he's the brightest kid in the class, but on the whole, kids don't inspire much confidence. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're cute and all, but we don't put them in charge of running companies or Congress. And then we don't put them in charge of multinational corporations or give them the levers of power for a reason. They're still mastering complex thoughts and complete sentences, to say nothing of not wetting the bed. Come on! My point exactly, Jesus says. Children don't run multinational conglomerations or push the levers of power, quite the opposite. Children have to be cared for and thought about. You have to be a little kinder a little gentler with children. Children demand honesty and patience. They approach the world with an openness to possibility and a sense of wonder at the amazingness of it all. They believe wholeheartedly in God and in what God can do, and they believe it without the taint of skepticism, albeit enlightened, or world-weary doubt. And as such, children are completely vulnerable. They depend wholly on the kindness of, if not strangers, parents and teachers, aunts and uncles, grandparents. Children depend on us to feed them and protect them, to teach them and guide them, even to acknowledge their very existence. Whoever welcomes such a one welcomes me, Jesus says. And not me, but really the one who sent me. And we churches like to think that we're welcoming congregations, that we value children. But friends, look around. Where are they? I mean, welcoming children is often harder than it sounds. How many of us have rolled our eyes when children get fidgety and worship, or silently say shh when an infant cries, or have gotten cross when we discover that the offering envelopes and the attendance pad and even the hymnals themselves have been used as coloring books? I would have to plead guilty to more than one of those charges. But my friends, if we struggle with children in worship, I submit to you we will struggle with the God we worship. An often fidgety God, not content to sit quietly in the pews while the preacher drones on, but a God who longs to run about among the congregation, meeting everyone God can, throwing wide God's arms in an open embrace. And those of us who want to block out the child's cries that are motivated by need might also be tempted to block out the cries of God's needy ones, the poor, the lonely, the oppressed, the marginalized, who cry out for bread and healing and comfort and justice. Those who are like me, who like a neat and tidy chapel, will probably be surprised by a God who refuses to stay in the lines, but who loves to display his creative and colorful brilliance across every imaginable medium. So, my friends, are we prepared to welcome God among us, to make time, to make room for a God who so closely identifies with children that he became one of them? Wisdom suggests that we ought to. Will we put women and children first?